Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to ModPath Chat, the official podcast of Modern Pathology, featuring interviews with authors and experts on the latest science, technology, and developments in the field of pathology. Your host, Dr. George Netto, is the editor-in-chief of Modern Pathology and the chair of pathology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Here's Dr. Netto.
My pleasure today to host one of the leading experts on renal cell carcinoma, Dr. Anthony Gill. Anthony is professor and senior staff specialist in anatomic pathology at the Royal North Shore Hospital in Sydney. Dr. Gill has co-authored over 500 manuscripts. He's also a standing editorial board member of the fifth edition of the WHO Blue Books. Anthony has been recognized with numerous awards, such as the Benjamin Castleman Award, the Ramsey Cutran Young Investigator Award, and in 2018, he was appointed as a member of the Order of Australia in the Queen's Birthday, honors for significant service to medical research in the field of surgical pathology as an academic, author, advisor, and mentor. This is great. So even the Queen now knows about surgical pathology, and hopefully she's going to follow our ModPath chat. Anthony will be joined by a rising star, his junior colleague, Dr. Talia Fuchs. She is a clinical senior lecturer from the University of Sydney. They will both discuss for us the recent Modern Pathology publication on SDH-deficient RCCs. So thank you both for accepting my invitation. And I realize it's very early in Australia and we have some time delay, but I'm sure it's going to be great. Thank you.
Thank you for having
us. Thanks very much for the kind words and a shout out to the Queen, if she's listening. It's about 8 a.m. here in Sydney, so it's not too early. And I look forward to the opportunity to discuss this this paper.
Wonderful. This the accent is going to be beautiful, so we're going to get a lot of audience just to listen to the beautiful accents of both of you.
We'll put another shrimp on the barbie for you when you come down.
All right. So let's get to business here. So the SDH deficient renal cell is no longer an emergent. Now it's a serious entity on its own, but I realize it's evolving. But for our audience, who not everybody does renal cell, can one of you start with setting the stage with a little background information about the entity?
Sure. I mean, maybe we'll talk about SDH deficient tumors in general and then the renal carcinoma. So we have an interest in endocrine pathology as well as urologic pathology. And we know that inferior chromosatoma and paraganglioma as a group, maybe up to 40% of those tumors are hereditary. And the most common hereditary cause is the group of disorders we call SDH deficiency. And they're almost always associated with germline mutations in one of the SDH genes, SDHA, SDHB, CD, or SDHAF2. And what's neat that what's emerged in endocrine pathology over the last 12 to 14 years is that there's a very simple immunohistochemical marker for SDH deficiency, and that is immunohistochemistry for SDHB. And basically, if a tumor shows loss of expression of SDHB, that's a very good marker that there's biallelic mutation in activation deletion in the tumor. And what we know from paraganglioma and inferior chromosatoma is that somatic only mutations are very, very rare, maybe 1% to 3% of SDH deficient cases. So with a simple immunohistochemical marker, we could identify pheochromocytomas and paragangliomas. Now, it's emerged over the last 15 or 20 years that patients with STH germline mutations have an increased risk of a few other tumours, clearly paraganglioma and pheochromocytoma is the most common, a unique subtype of GIST known as STH deficient GIST, quite rarely pituitary adenomas, in some setting pulmonary chondromas, and of course renal cell carcinoma. Now, it would be really beneficial to be able to identify patients, index patients presenting with STH deficiency with renal cell carcinoma. When we first started looking at this about 12 years ago, we had a few kindreds. We have about 500 kindreds throughout the whole. We do centralized testing for a lot of Australia here. And we knew that they had renal carcinomas. And they'd been called a variety of things from oncocytoma, clear cell carcinoma, chromophobes over the years. And we thought we'd pull them all together and have a look at them one after another. And the first case that we saw had a very distinctive morphology, eosinophilic cells, quite peculiar and unusual intracytoplasmic inclusions that ultra-structurally look like giant mitochondria, and sort of a nested architecture with cytoplasms eosinophilic but not quite oncocytic. And I remember very clearly when we saw the first patient, we got another patient in, and these are quite rare, so they're mostly consultation cases. And I looked at that slide and thought, oh, gee, they've accidentally sent me the same person's tumour twice because they had the same surname because they were related. And then we looked into it, actually, it was the same kindred. There was a daughter and mother. And we saw in that first report a very distinctive morphology of this nested growth pattern, eosinophilic cell type, epithelioid cytology, quite rounded, bland cells. And you know, it's in the sort of gray zone between oncocytoma and chromophobe, but not really compatible with both. So we put it out there as this is an emerging entity with a distinctive morphology. But what's been very beneficial is that that simple immunohistochemical marker, SDHB, has been a really great marker. So you can screen large numbers of tumours to find this very rare entity. Now, we had a series of publications, and a shout out to Kirill Tripkov, who helped with a subsequent follow-up publication in the American Journal of Surgical Pathology, and of course the late great Andre Hess, who was a giant in the field, who in all these collaborations couldn't do enough to help and just provided so much, and a great loss to surgical pathology with his recent death. Anyway, we put together, and again, because we were screening first by morphology, there's a selection bias that obviously cases with classic morphology are easier to recognize. There are other clues at family history of the other syndromic stuff. So as this became more widely recognised, we received more and more cases for consultation. Lots of places don't have STHB immunohistochemistry, and it can be a difficult stain to interpret because significance is placed on loss of expression rather than positive stain. So we get a lot of cases in for consultation. And obviously a lot of them, most of them are not STH deficiency, but some of them are. And whilst many, many had classic morphology, we saw a few patterns emerging of what we'll call variant morphology, features that aren't quite typical. And then we had another cohort, as molecular testing is becoming increasingly more widely available, where morphology wasn't a part in the identification of these tumours. People had done broad panel testing, of which the STH genes were on most panels, and they pulled out these tumours not suspecting the STH deficiency, and we go back and retrospectively review them. So as is always the way with these newer entities, it goes from a very classic type morphology to evolve towards more variant morphologies. Often these tumours have those stereotypical features very focally, but when you're flying through a lot of slides, you don't see them. So we thought we should put together these variant morphologies to put them out there for surgical pathologists to recognise, and then explore more about the predictive and prognostic factors, the risk of germline mutation, and other factors I think help in the clinical management of these patients.
Put together, so we, and the we here is probably at least 50 authors, so I And that's a testimony to the great networks of urologic pathology and how collaborative our community is. I'm being one of them. Unfortunately, I'm not on the paper, but because I love bladder, I'm not so enamored with kidney, so I didn't give you any of the cases. But this is, and I thank you for mentioning giving credit to the late Andre and to Kirill Trepkov. By the way, Andre was a guest on this podcast, one of our earliest guests, and it's been so tragic to lose such a friend and colleague. So you put together the group, and it's around, 62 tumors from 59 patients. I guess, Dalia, can you tell us a little bit more about how you conducted the study? Since, after all, we know the first author do all the work, and the senior is just a senior sitting there.
Trying to enter everyone's names and email addresses into the editorial manager was one of the hardest parts of this paper.
Yes, I agree. Took the whole first page.
Yeah, that's right. As you said, we had 62 tumors from 59 patients. So there were three patients that had two tumors. And a lot of these came to Anthony as consultation cases. And we also reached out and asked people to send us any cases that, were difficult to classify or were from anyone with a suggestive family history or from young patients, for example. And so we asked everyone to send us some formalin-fixed paraffin-embedded tissue or unstained slides, and we wanted to do SDH staining on any cases that hadn't had that performed already. A lot of them already had. And we went through and reviewed them all, did the SDH A and B, amongst some other stains as well. And we confirmed that all of these cases were indeed SDHB deficient. And then sort of just looked at the morphology and described all the different histological patterns. And then I did some statistical analyses. We did have a bit of follow-up data from most of the patients, but not all. It's always tricky getting good follow-up data when you've got these multi-institutional and international cohorts, but we did actually get quite a bit of follow-up data, which was really useful in looking at the behavior of this entity and comparing it with non-SDH deficient tumors.
And I realized some of them, I think if I'm correct, 18 of them did have some germline assessment, correct? And
that's right. They had known germline variants in SDHB. Yeah.
So that's the only molecular you did. You didn't do additional molecular.
No, we couldn't get any further molecular testing. And unfortunately, we didn't have any patients with mutations in the other SDH genes, which would have been nice. But that's what we had.
Excellent. So
I suppose that's a point just to make, that often these tumors, it's not just, although we use SDHB as a marker, they have mutations of SDHC or SDHA, SDHD, I'm not sure how common that is. It's probably quite rare, but often contributors have only done SDHB mutation testing, and really you should go on, if it's SDHB negative, to look for other SDH mutations. So the majority seem to have germline mutations.
SDHA, but you use the SDHB in immuno.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a trick that tumors with mutations in A, B, C, D, or AF2 show loss of expression of SDHB. Tumors with mutations in SDHA show loss of expression in SDHA as well as SDHB. So we normally do them in parallel. If it's SDHA negative, they probably have an SDHA mutation, which are not uncommon in the general population, but have a very low penetrance.
Excellent. So what are the findings? What are the patterns? And this is such a relatively big cohort. So
yeah, so we found a lot of the tumors, most tumors had that conventional morphology that Anthony described, at least focally. but there were also a significant number, I think it was about 13, that had this variant morphology, and there were all sorts of different patterns. So there were, you know, solid sheets, sarcomatoid. We had some that showed some papillary architecture, you know, stromal desmoplasia. A couple of cases had rhabdoid morphology. So it was really variable. But the other thing that we found was that even cases that had the typical morphology, so typically they would have really low nuclear grade, so ISUP grade 1 or 2, some cases actually had just the only variation was that their nuclear grade was a little bit higher. And those cases we actually found behaved more aggressively, even in the absence of actual variant morphological architectures. And the other thing that we found was quite interesting was the presence of necrosis. So even in cases with otherwise completely typical morphology, having necrosis was another really poor prognostic factor. And there were three cases altogether that had entirely variant morphology with no areas of conventional morphology. So that's a really interesting point, because these cases would not have been picked up as SDH deficient if we hadn't just been screening them. And I suppose this study eliminates that selection bias that we get from only screening cases that have a suggestive history or suggestive morphology. So now we can see that there's actually a really broad range of appearances that we can get with these tumors.
You can have necrosis, and just to emphasize for the audience, you can have necrosis with the typical morphology, and that by itself is significant.
Correct.
And you can have a typical morphology with areas where the nuclear grade or that you would have interpreted as a higher grade, and that's also a cause for concern in term of prognosis.
That's right, and we sort of suggested in the paper, because as it stands, we don't typically report the nuclear grade for these tumors because they're all accepted, you know, we think that they're all low grade, no, low nuclear grade. But we suggest that perhaps it's important to actually include the nuclear grade in our reports because it does have some prognostic significance. So maybe that's something to consider going forward.
That's really important. Other implications from the findings of the study?
So I suppose the main one is just for pathologists to have a lower threshold for doing SDH immunohistochemistry, even in cases that don't have any of the typical morphologic features. So I suppose in young patients, anyone with a family history or a personal history of other SDH deficient tumor types. And just to look out as well for these variant morphologies, but also look at the nuclear grade and look for necrosis. I think those are really important things to include in the report.
Excellent. And Anthony, anything else you want to add to what Talia so eloquently?
Yeah, I think Talia makes excellent points that most renal tumors we see fit very nicely into clearly defined categories, but you do see these rare things that you just can't fit into anything. And it really is good to have a low threshold to do not just SDHB immunochemistry, but you know, fumarate hydridase and 2SC, because we also look for HLRCC and a few other tests. So it's easy for us because we've got these stains on hand. We don't have to send them away, pay someone outside to do it. I suppose clues, apart from the morphology, which is described in detail in the paper, is that these tumours often show little or no cytokeratin expression. They're negative for c-Kit, but that sometimes highlights intratumoral mast cells. And these are sort of things that might push you towards sending it away if you don't have the marker in-house. And, of course, the clinical things, the family history of pheochromocytoma, if they suggest von Hippel-Lindau syndrome, but they don't have VHR or classic Liz or renal carcinoma. Yeah, and we've mentioned GIST and pulmonary chondroma and pituitary tumours and Theo. But really, considering it, the marker is quite robust. Just considering doing the marker in any difficult to classify tumour is a fairly high yield.
Thank you. Yeah, and for the audience, the reason you mentioned c-Kit because in the past these interim differential of oncocytoma and still. And the first thing, one of the things you do is seek it to be in that category, chromo or onco and CK7, and having a negative c-kit should clue you in, and then you take the next step.
Yeah, exactly.
And just wanted to add, hopefully the whole idea of the podcast that the audience will go and read the paper. We can't talk about every, unfortunately, due to the limitations of time, every single thing. But I was struck by some of the patterns, the microcystic and that myxoid mucinous that you mentioned. These as I always tell our fellows and residents, anything nowadays can look like anything. So you end up doing SDH and FH. A lot of time, you know, I fully agree with the low threshold, but even out sometimes we end up doing whenever we cannot classify a tumor, we do these because, like you said, we have them. And the hope is sometimes you're going to capture these and it's going to have a significant either therapeutically or prognostically. So we're stuck with this because, like you said, the original morphology is never staying as the pathognomonic as much as we would have loved to. Any closing remarks, Talia?
No, I suppose that's it. The only other thing to say is, as I mentioned, like 95% of our cases did focally have the conventional morphology. So, you know, if you're in a place where it's hard to have access to these immunohistochemical stains, look really carefully, hunt around and see if you can find some of those inclusions or anything that looks somewhat suggestive that could help. But yeah.
Thank you. This has been very helpful to me even zoom in on some of the new features, and I'm sure our audience are going to appreciate. And thank you again both for taking the time from across continents, but we love Zoom for this. So
thanks
very much, George. It's been an absolute pleasure. We've enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Any opinions expressed in this podcast are the speaker's own and do not represent the views of Modern Pathology, Springer Nature, UAB, or USCAP. Your ModPath Chat host and scientific director is Dr. George Netto. Producers are Christina Crow, Amber Jackson, Dr. Sarah Jang, and Dr. Catherine Ketchum. Technical direction is provided by Kaminsky Productions, music by Mitch Neubauer. Thanks to the authors, reviewers, and editors of Modern Pathology for making this podcast possible.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.